everybody. I'm Julia. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 15th of 2006. And I do have a sponsor and a home group. And I'm currently using that sponsor and that home group. And it's a pleasure to be here today at the Blue Ridge Speakers Group and share my story with all of you. Best I can do is give you the truth. So try not to be too nervous or too worried about that, because I do remember that. I know what my story is, so that's all I have to do today. And the reason that I'm here is not because I'm necessarily special or anybody different. It's in fact the opposite. It's because I'm just like you all. I am an alcoholic, and sometimes I do need to be reminded of that. This is as much for me as it is for anyone else who might identify with what I have to say. So with that, I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like today. So I started drinking relatively early, started drinking when I was about 14. My story isn't very long. Like many female alcoholics, it didn't really take me that long to get to a point where I needed some help. And before I started drinking, I was very uncomfortable, pretty much as far back as I can remember. Always felt different, always felt like I didn't look quite right or didn't fit in with my family members, or like didn't know, you know, the right pop culture references to fit in with kids my age or what have you. Whatever it is, I always found a reason that I felt different. And in some ways I was a little bit different, but, you know, nothing too out of the ordinary, but it was enough for me to feel isolated, feel different. And that feeling didn't really go away or get better for a long time. It just kept getting worse and more intense and more uncomfortable, and my chest just kept getting tighter, and I kept thinking, you know, maybe the reason that I feel different is because I'm better than everybody else, or, you know, I'm this or I'm that, and I just couldn't really find any way to make that feeling go away or make it okay in any way. And by the time I started high school, I was pretty sick. I wasn't really talking to anybody my age. I wasn't really talking to my parents. I wasn't really getting a lot of input from anybody else. And my head was already really chugging along like full steam with negative stuff. And I had started trying to find other ways to make myself feel better, like trying to eat a lot or not eat at all, or trying to hurt myself, or maybe trying to hurt other people. And I was just a mess. But I did somehow end up finding somebody the first day of high school that was kind of similar to me. And that was my first experience with kind of feeling like maybe I wasn't the only one, like I wasn't some kind of alien that had dropped out of outer space somehow. Because I always did kind of feel like that, that I felt different in a way that, like, if I told people really what I was thinking, they would look at me like I was crazy. And so I just stopped telling people what I was thinking, ever. which is not a great way to live, but I did make this one friend. And throughout, you know, the first most of that year, she would drink and she would do drugs and she would come to school a mess, and we would still be friends, but I would think, oh, I'm not going to get that bad. Like, I'm not going to do that stuff. But by the end of ninth grade, I was still a mess in my own way and still really uncomfortable, and actually just leaving school at that point. I was going to leave school, and I ended up having to go to a different school for kids with issues, funnily enough. But over that summer, let me backtrack a little bit and say another thing that I tried to make myself feel better was listening to lots of really angry music and finding people that also really liked that music and going to, like, local concerts all around that allowed kids of, like, any age to go. And part of what I liked about that atmosphere was not just that I could kind of feel cool and dangerous, or, like, you know, part of something secret, or, you know, get my anger out. I also liked that people were drinking a lot at these places and doing drugs in these places. And I wasn't with them yet on that end, but I was getting a vicarious thrill from that that I wasn't even really aware of at the time. And so at one of these concerts that I went to, I met a boy, as it so often goes, and I thought he was pretty cute, and these were the days of, like, AIM Instant Messenger. So I called him up on the Instant Messenger and started talking to him, and it turns out, thankfully for me, that he actually had some kind of moral decency and didn't want to date a 14-year-old. but he didn't see any problem with getting me drunk, because I had somehow come up in conversation that, like, I had never tried alcohol before, and him being 21 and I guess maybe, you know, a little bit charitable. I don't know what to say about that, but it wasn't a call that I hope anybody else would make at 21. They thought it would be a great idea to, like, get me drunk, because it's, like, funny that I even want to, I guess. But I went and met him at his apartment in College Park one day, totally alone, older man, apartment. I don't know where I am, right? This could go terribly wrong. But thankfully for me, it didn't, and all that happened was I ended up drinking, like, 6 Smirnoff Ice in a row and feeling amazing and, like, feeling really impressed with myself. Like, I had 6, and your roommate can only do 2 at a time, and, like, And I just felt special, like, for the first time, really, in a really long time, if not ever. I felt like something different about me was good. Like, I had this ability that other people didn't have. I had a tolerance that other people didn't have. And it just made me feel like everything was going to be okay. And I remember distinctly that feeling of relief that I got from alcohol that day. I remember distinctly feeling like, if I can just do this for the rest of my life, I can be okay. Like, I can maybe fit in or not care that I don't. And, you know, nothing really matters. And I'm having a good time. I'm just feeling okay and good enough and present in the moment, which had basically never happened before. And, you know, I also inaugurated one of my favorite games that day called This Doesn't Hurt, where if you haven't played that game, maybe you've played it by a different set of rules or a different name, but that's when you start doing things that should hurt if you're sober and it doesn't hurt and it's hilarious, like banging your head against a wall, you know, stuff like that. So that was the first time I played that game. That was the first time I blacked out. That was the first time I puked on myself and, you know, somehow took the metro home at like 11 o'clock at night and thought that was the best day of my life. And, like, I couldn't wait to do it again. And I did get grounded for the rest of the summer. I totally got grounded over that. But I knew that it was worth it. Anything that I had to face felt like it would be worth it to feel that way again. And the next opportunity I got, I was back at it. And then from there, I just kept trying to find alcohol and kept trying to drink any time that I could, which is not so easy when you're 14. But I did what I could and made some older friends, some of whom were not as nice as that first guy, and, you know, made friends with other people my age who somehow could get their hands on things. And my story does also include some dry goods, things other than alcohol, which were just easier to get at the time for me. I also sort of felt like, you know, I was a person of extremes. I kind of still can be, where I either wanted to be all the way up or all the way down, and alcohol was, like, my choice of how to be all the way down. And some other things helped me get all the way up, and they were easier to find, especially at the special school that I went to, where the kids were taking medicine or, you know, doing drugs. And so that was a little bit easier for me to get. And my drinking didn't really get super bad probably until a couple years later, 16, 17, to the point where, you know, I'm already at this special school. Standards are a little bit low, but I am just doing my homework drunk and, like, getting A's on it and going to school messed up occasionally. And all day long in class, all I'm thinking about is, like, when do I get out of here so I can go home and drink? And I remember that feeling also very distinctly, of that, you know, discomfort, that this ease of just needing a drink after high school, you know, after a good 5 hours of sitting. It felt like the worst feeling in the world. And, you know, that's what I did. I mean, my drinking isn't very exciting. It's not very flashy. It's not very glamorous. Mostly what I did would be drink cheap vodka alone watching TV in my house, or like drink cheap beer in the woods, or, you know, go to a party occasionally and then leave because they wouldn't give me the booze fast enough, and people get mad at you when you're at their house at their party asking when they're going to start drinking and get over with all this stupid social stuff, you know? I actually did get kicked out of a party because I wanted to drink faster than everybody else. But that's the kind of drinker I am. It's like, I'm not here to make friends. I'm not here to, like, socialize. I'm here for the alcohol and that alone, which doesn't make for a very fancy time, doesn't make you a lot of friends. You know, I very quickly became the girl that was the problem. I was the project. I needed to be babysat, and, like, nobody wants to hang out with that. Nobody wants to hang out with the girl that's falling over, or, you know, trying to, like, sneak past people, or, you know, flirting with their boyfriends, or, you know, nobody wants to hang out with that girl, especially not if she's throwing up basically every time. I do have one example of being in the downtown shopping area where I live. That's at night. It's like a summer night. There's teenagers all around just like me, but I'm drunk. And so my friends are kind of with me, propping me up. At one point, I pass out inside of a large flower pot, and then they get me out of that, and then they're like, well, maybe we should sober you up, take you over to this restaurant and get something to eat. So I eat it all in like 5 minutes and then throw it all up on the floor, and then we have to apologize to the restaurant people and then drag me out of the thing and then, like, somehow get me home and, like, not get caught. And that's really the most exciting thing that ever happened while I was drinking, is that I would throw up on something and then people would be stuck trying to clean me up and I'd have to somehow sneak home. Like, that's really the most exciting thing that ever happened. And most of the time I would just avoid that by drinking alone and not going anywhere. And my life just got really, really small. Really small, really lonely, just like it had started out before I started going places and going to concerts and meeting people. And that all ended very quickly because it was just too inconvenient. It was too hard. And people didn't really want to be around me when I drink like I want to drink. And when I did drink, I always drank the way that I wanted to drink because I can't control and enjoy my drinking at the same time. I can control my drinking. I can limit myself, or I used to be able to, when I was drinking, limit myself in order to protect my drinking. Like, if I knew I could only have so many, because if I had more, then it would look weird or look suspicious, or, you know, I might get caught, or I won't have enough for next time. I could kind of grit my teeth and do that, but I couldn't enjoy that. And then if I did want to enjoy my drinking, there was no control. Like, I knew kind of a ballpark number of, like, how much I normally have to drink to feel the way that I want to feel, but I couldn't tell you whether or not I was going to stop there. I couldn't tell you if I was going to hit that mark. I couldn't tell you what I was going to do when I got there. I couldn't tell you who I was going to do that with or where. You know, I got into lots of cars with people I didn't know. I got into lots of alleys with people I didn't know. And, like, sometimes both of us were drunk, sometimes just me. And somehow, you know, I made it out with not too many bumps and bruises, really. But eventually, you know, what it really came down to was not the outside consequences for me. It was the inside consequences of feeling like I had just given up everything. Every single part of myself had just gone, and I was hollowed out inside. I remember one time going to get something that wasn't alcohol with another friend of mine who was going to get the same thing, and then she had the nerve to suggest I might have a problem. And in my mind, I'm like, come on, we're, like, on the same trip here. We're going to go get the same thing and do the same thing. What's your problem? But even the people that would still hang out with me at that point kind of knew that, like, something was wrong in a way that it wasn't wrong with them. And I just kind of blew that off. But I remember that same day kind of looking at myself in the mirror and not really recognizing, like, who that was, because it's not something I had the habit of doing very often anymore. I just didn't really pay attention to anything that was part of reality. And so I just remember that feeling too, of just feeling totally scooped out and hollowed out on the inside and not really caring. Because ultimately, at that point in my drinking, 16, 17 years old, my goal was to die and hope that it looked like an accident. Like maybe I just drank too much or took the wrong thing, because I would take things that people gave me and not really know what they were. And I really just didn't want to live anymore. Like I didn't know how to live with alcohol or without alcohol, and it wasn't very much fun either way at that point, and I was just so tired. And I didn't know what to do, and I was just kind of hoping that I wouldn't wake up. But that was not to be, thankfully. I don't really know how I survived all that, but I did. And eventually what happened was, also, I don't know how this happened, but I did get accepted into a college after I graduated high school. And that kind of summer between high school and college was some of the worst of my drinking. For instance, one of my grandfathers passed away that summer, and I used that as an excuse to get even crazier. Just drink all the time, drink anywhere I wanted, all day long, like to the point where like other people still didn't would still not hang out with me, but like even the people who would occasionally hang out with me were like really concerned, and just kind of getting back into that isolated place and accelerating my drinking even further. And I remember going to the funeral service in Pennsylvania and just being pissed off the entire time that I had to stay sober that weekend. And you know, that really, once I got sober, that really impressed upon me, like, what was going on. Like, I feel terrible about that to this day. But that's the kind of drinker that I was. That's the kind of hold that alcohol had on me at that point, was that somebody that I loved and somebody that loved me and cared about me passed away, and I'm thinking about, this is really inconvenient because I can't drink in front of my family. And that was the reality of my drinking. But I did go and ended up going to college mostly because I thought it would be kind of a place where people wouldn't supervise me as much. People would get off my back. I could kind of drink like I wanted to, because the only experience I'd had with college up to that point was like these old movies that they would show on Comedy Central where everybody's drinking all the time and it's fine. So I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's going to be exactly what it's going to be like, and there won't be any like academic expectations or anything silly like that. So I go. And by this point, I've already met my roommate, and I've had what I thought was a very reasonable talk with her about how I'm going to do drugs and drink, and you're going to be okay with that, right? And she lied and said that she would be fine with that, and I didn't know she was lying until I got there. So I'm staying up all night doing things that I like to do while she's trying to sleep, and never once considering that that might be a problem in the same room as somebody else. And she kind of got real sick of that real fast and called the campus cops on me, which I thought was really rude and inappropriate and just uncalled for, because we had had an agreement. And I'd also just had my nose pierced at that time, so I had a bag of salt for cleaning it, essentially. And so the campus cops come, and, like, I come. I have been drinking already that evening, but not very much at this point. And they find that, and they're like, yeah, it's just salt, whatever, lady, like, calm down. And so they let me off the hook the first time. And then I go back and go drinking with my new friends that I've found within the first few days. Like, this is still orientation, guys. And I haven't even been to a class. And so they go, and she calls them back. Because by the time they leave after the first call, I sit her down and I tell her that I thought that was really rude and inappropriate. And I believe my exact words were something along the lines of, like, that's not cool. I actually do have drugs. Like, why would you do that? And to me, that's a totally reasonable conversation to have with someone at the time. It's like, come on, you said you wouldn't tell. And she didn't think that was reasonable, so she called them back because I've just confessed to a crime. And they find it this time. And by the time that they find me, I am now so drunk that I just don't have any more fight left. I know that I'm screwed. I know it's over. and I just don't feel like fighting it anymore. So I show them where everything is, and it's like, yeah, that's what it is. This is how much I have. Like, can I, like, go to sleep now? And so I cannot go to sleep now. They put me in the back of their car and take me to the hospital, which I also think is really unnecessary because this is like a very typical day of drinking for me and doing whatever else I was doing, and I didn't see that there was a problem with combining those two substances, but apparently it's very dangerous, and so they had to take me to the ER. And also by this point, you know, I'm not a very large person, and, you know, the amount of alcohol that I had, they found somewhat unusual. So they decided to commit me to the ER, and at this point, I'm not yet 18. I'm 17 and a half, roughly, and so I can't check myself out when I'm done. And so I'm stuck there, and I kind of just start off the evening kind of just, you know, whatever, it's fine, I'm going to get out of here. And then I start getting really belligerent with the doctor, which they don't like, why am I here? I don't have to be here, and trying to leave, and they don't like that. So then I'm, you know, strapped down, and I just, all I remember after that point is how cold the IV drip was going into my hand. But I stayed there for about 15 hours, and I don't remember most of that. And by the time I was getting out, they had called my mom to come to New Jersey, where my school was, all the way from Maryland. And so now she's had to make this emergency trip of like 4.5 hours and find out that I've been doing what I've been doing, which she didn't really know about up until this time. So she is thrilled. She's just thrilled with me and the situation. And, you know, when people talk about that look that we all get at some point during our drinking career of just like, how could you? You know, that's the look that I remember from that day in particular of just, you know, there being nothing behind my mom's eyes except just utter bewilderment and like disappointment and just like, we're going to get through this because we have to, but then after that I might never speak to you again because I don't know who you are, like all of that in the look. And we had to kind of suck it up and like go to a bunch of meetings with school officials, and just, it was several days of just trying to clean up this mess that I had made. And, you know, thankfully, I don't know for sure, but I believe my school at some point had read a copy of To Employers, because what they offered me was a chance to get sober if I wanted to come back. I could no longer live on campus unless I completed a rehab, and to do that, I basically had to come back to Maryland. And so that's my what happened, essentially, is I got caught at school, and I was told that I had to complete a rehab if I wanted to finish school. And, you know, before that happened, I probably would have told you I didn't care whether or not I got to complete school. But, you know, something, some moment of clarity during that experience kind of made me panic of like, oh, crap, if I don't actually do this, like, I'm not getting another shot at this. Like, this is probably my best shot to a life that I might actually want to live and, like, be successful at. And so that was enough to kind of make me agree to go to some meetings before I go home and then, like, go to a rehab. And I remember also thinking in some of those very early meetings that, like, you know, I actually identified. And I'll backtrack a little bit and say that my friend from high school that I mentioned earlier, she got sent to rehab much earlier than me and would invite me periodically to meetings as support and like to go with her. But then I later found out she was trying to 12-step me. So like I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard kind of the definition of what an alcoholic might be. And in my drinking, I thought that was cute, that like, okay, so maybe I'm an alcoholic, and that means that you need to give me your alcohol because I need it more than you, right? And, you know, I just didn't understand the gravity of the situation that I found myself in and didn't really think I 100% identified, but the seed was planted for me in that I kind of knew there was a place I could go if I ever wanted to, and I didn't think I would ever want to or would ever need to. But I kind of knew it was there. So by the time I got to this place with school where I had to go, I immediately related in and was you know, really upset about that. You know, I remember crying in the first meetings that I went to, not because I was in trouble or felt bad, but because I felt like, oh, crap, I am one of these people. I have to do what they do. This is awful. And, you know, I mean, for a 17-year-old, you can't imagine anything worse than sitting in church basements with old people for the rest of your life and, like, never having any more fun, which is what I thought was going to happen. And, you know, I didn't really have a lot of experience to tell me anything different, because up to that point, I had never been to a young people's meeting. I didn't know that those existed. I just knew that I knew some people who were young who had gone to meetings or were going to meetings, and they just didn't seem to be having a very good time, and they didn't seem to be staying sober. So, I mean, I thought if I wanted to stay sober, I just had to go to these old people meetings and suffer. And I thought that maybe also that's what I deserved for the life that I've been living. But thankfully, that was also not the case. So I had, funnily enough, a next-door neighbor that was also sober and at some point had tried to 12-step me as well, which I only remembered after I got sober. And he took me to my first young person's meeting, where I then met members of the home group that I have today. But without all these encounters with people, I mean, everything that added up the way that it did, I wouldn't be here. So I'm very grateful for that. And anyway, I ended up staying sober, not through any virtue of my own or any real desire of my own, because as soon as I got home from those meetings in New Jersey, where I started to really identify, you know, my alcoholic mind twists so fast from, like, oh, crap, I have to stay sober, to, like, oh, crap, I still have alcohol at home, I better drink it all. And that's what happened, is every single thing I had in the house, I had to finish it, because why would you let that go to waste, you know, like 24 hours distant from a time where I'm thinking I want to change my life, I'm back to, well, we can't just throw that out. And so that's what I did, and I had another experience that's still very fresh in my mind of, you know, doing some of the dry goods that I had around, you know, in my bathroom, as you do, and thinking, I don't really want to be doing this right now. This is not what I want to do. But still being powerless from stopping myself from doing it, just actually looking at myself do these things and feeling disembodied almost from the person that was doing it, because I didn't want to do it. I just couldn't stop of my own volition. I couldn't make myself of my own will not do those things. And then by the time I got into rehab a couple days later, which is my sobriety date, because I knew you had to, like, test clean to start rehab, or at least the program that I was in, I had already started back onto, like, scheming of, like, oh, I'm just going to play this. I'm going to play this rehab. I'm going to get an A+. Everybody's going to tell me what a good girl I am, and then I'm going to go do what I want. And so that was how I entered into rehab, thinking of just, like, I'm just going to get everybody off my back. And thankfully, I was able to, well, I was forced to stay dry and stay clean long enough that eventually I did have a change of heart. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know why it happened. I know it has nothing to do with me. I believe it was my higher power today that somehow found a crack in my very hard head and got in there. But at some point during that rehab experience, I remember having the realization that I no longer wanted to die. And that was a really strange feeling for me. And I kind of just latched onto that and thought, okay, you know, so maybe I don't want to die, but do I want to do what I have to do to stay alive? That's the other question that I had to answer in rehab. And I thought, okay, you know, I'll give this a shot. If this is what they're telling me I have to do, I have to go to meetings, I have to stay sober, I have to get one of these sponsor people and, like, kind of listen to them, I'll just give it a try, you know. And I've heard other people, since I've been sober, put it in terms of, you can always kill yourself later, you know. Just give it 30 days, you can kill yourself after that. And that's kind of how I thought about it at the time, was just like, what do I have to lose? Like, I have literally nothing to lose. I have negative nothing to lose at this point, so I'll just give this a try. Like, it felt nice to kind of not always be looking over my shoulder. It felt nice to kind of, you know, have a break from always trying to think about what am I going to get, where am I going to get it, when am I getting it, who am I getting it from, just constantly having that wheel turning all day long and being so miserable and discontent all the time. It was just nice to take a breath for a little bit and think about one other thing other than that. And that was enough to kind of keep me going to meetings. And so I went to all the meetings that they made me get slips for, and I went to a couple more meetings that I wasn't required to go to. And I went to meetings in a couple of different fellowships for a little while because I wasn't sure what my real problem was. I really didn't want it to be alcohol, which is why it's alcohol. And, you know, I really wanted it to be this other stuff, because this other stuff, after a little while, I didn't really think about it anymore. I didn't really want it anymore. It was just kind of getting over that physical hump of, like, being addicted to these things. And I thought that would just be so much easier if that was it, you know, then I wouldn't have to do all this. But that's not my story. My story is that I had two sponsors for a little while, but eventually, like, it was brought to my attention that that wasn't probably the smartest way for me personally to go, because I was kind of playing them off each other and checking something with one person and checking it with the other person and then picking the answer I liked. And on top of that, I just wasn't really relating as much with the other fellowship I was in. I wasn't getting as much out of the meetings. I just didn't feel like that was really the right place for me. And so I ended up going and choosing AA full time. And I'm very glad that I did. My AA sponsor, actually, you know, there's no wrong way to get a sponsor. If you're wondering, I know a lot of the young people that I talk to are very concerned that they pick exactly the right person the first time, and they have to, like, be some spiritual giant. They have to be exactly the same as you, and that's really not the case, in my experience anyway. And unfortunately, or I guess fortunately, the best tools that I had at the time were to pick somebody that kind of looked the way that I thought I wanted to look, like, just completely outwardly. Like, she dressed kind of like the people that I used to go to concerts with, so I felt comfortable with that. But she seemed happier than they did, and she was sober. And so I thought, okay, everybody else here looks like people I wouldn't normally hang out with. They make me uncomfortable for one reason or another. They look too happy, too clean, too put together, you know, too much like, you know, people I judge. And so I picked this person, and, you know, we had a good relationship for a little while. But unfortunately, our relationship was such that she wanted to be more of my friend than my sponsor. And I didn't know any different, so I didn't think that was a problem. But eventually, I wound up getting back into school and going there and getting a phone call from the woman who's my sponsor now. And, you know, that phone call was that my first sponsor drank and was gone. She left. And so I was shocked, right? I didn't think that was possible. Like, in my mind at this point, very early sobriety, maybe 4 months sober, you know, I had just done a fourth step with this person, and I thought, like, well, if you're sober, you just stay sober. Like, this is it. And I was so shocked that somebody sober could, you know, make a mistake or make a bad choice. But my current sponsor was there to pick up the pieces in that situation. And thankfully, you know, she still sponsors me, but that's something that I got to stay sober through and learn that it doesn't really matter even if you end up picking your sponsor, because I didn't pick the sponsor I have now. She picked me. But we relate on a really deep level, but we don't look anything alike outwardly. So that was a lesson for me. All that's important is that I could listen to her. And for a long time in my early sobriety, I didn't actually, because I didn't call her very much. I was up in New Jersey, going to my New Jersey meetings, talking to New Jersey people. Like, I was getting kind of input and guidance from other sober people, just not my sponsor, for like years, which I don't recommend at all. Because while I was able to stay sober, the quality of my sobriety was just drastically different from what it is today. I don't know how to describe it other than I wasn't quite living my drunk life sober, but I was getting very close, because I didn't really have enough time before that move to change enough to really be different. Clearly, I was different enough not to drink, but only just. I was going to meetings, I was talking to people, but unfortunately, I was still kind of going by my own head. I was going by what I thought was good, what I thought was right, what I thought was, you know, spiritual in the meeting, or, you know, whatever I thought. And that decision kind of led me to a place that got pretty dangerous. Like, I used to go hang out with people who were drinking and, like, go hang out with them while they were drinking. And I had a sober boyfriend, like, right away, which is not recommended. And, like, you know, that relationship dragged on for, like, 4.5 years. And ended just awfully, awfully terrible. But I was able to stay sober through that. And when I came back home, I was able to kind of get back into things, thankfully, after school. I did kind of get to a point where I thought I was kind of backing out of AA. Like, I wasn't really hanging out with people. I wasn't still really being that honest with my sponsor. And all I was thinking about was, like, okay, this new boyfriend's going to fix me. And just totally not being present in AA. And that didn't work out very well for you, for your spiritual health, or at least not for me, because I was making this relationship my higher power. And that also ended, fortunately enough. And only at that point, I think I was maybe, like, 6 years sober. At that point, maybe 5 years sober, did I finally get a program, you guys. And started trying to sponsor women and going to more meetings and, like, doing things that I was uncomfortable with that were, like, suggested to me in AA. Anything other than what was my idea pretty much wasn't on the menu up till then. But I just didn't have any other ideas at that point. Like, I knew that if I continued doing my program, essentially, I was going to drink, because there was just nothing left in it for me. There were not really that many friends. I wasn't having a good time. But, like, on the inside, I was getting back to that place that I talked about before, of that feeling, like, scooped out on the inside, of just, like, I don't have a recovery that is a sufficient substitute for drinking at that point. And if I put myself in another position where, like, desire and opportunity could cross, I really wasn't sure what was going to happen. And that was enough for me to start working with my sponsor again, like, a little bit more intensely, a little bit more honestly, and, like, slowly peel down all these layers that I had built up while I was drinking and never really bothered to peel down up until that point, and really let people in and talk to my pigeon sisters and talk to my friends honestly and, like, tell people real things about myself, you know? Like, that was the only way that I ever got real help in Alcoholics Anonymous, was to be honest. be honest with basically anybody where appropriate, because anybody's input was better than my head at that time. And it wasn't flattering to me. It didn't, like, put me in a great light that I had been sober for, like, 5 or 6 years and wasn't doing jack. It didn't look nice, you know, that I had made a boy my higher power. It didn't look nice that, like, I didn't really allow myself to be sponsored. It wasn't the image I wanted for myself, but, you know, I was gonna die. So the alternative looked pretty good, just, you know, be embarrassed, kind of, because nobody actually really cared what I had to say other than, like, the fact that I was asking for help. And that was an amazing relief to me as well, is that, you know, I found at least that I can be honest about anything in AA. I can be honest with anybody in AA, as long as the point is to get help. You know, I'm not saying run around, you know, with your pants on your head screaming your innermost thoughts. I'm just saying, like, for me, if I landed in a home group, at least, where if I have something going on, I can share it with anybody if I want help. And I'm not trying to shock people or trying to, you know, manipulate a situation. If I'm being honest and the point is that I want help, somebody will help me or take me to somebody who can help me. And that saved my life at that point. I was in a meeting I didn't normally go to, and I just shared that I thought I was on my way out, you know, and I got so much help after that meeting and, you know, got right back into the work here and back into the steps. And, you know, my life really hasn't been the same since then. I do feel like, you know, I don't really regret that, because that's what it took me to get to the point where I am now. But I definitely compromised the quality of my sobriety early on, and I wish that I hadn't, because what I have now is so, so much better. I have now what I was always looking for when I was drinking. You know, I have that sense of belonging with other people. I have that security that I'm going to be okay and that everything's going to be okay, which only for me comes from a relationship with a higher power. You know, and I have that sense of, like, ease and comfort that a drink could bring me after a hard day of middle school or high school, you know. And I feel like I can be honest. I feel like I can be myself and say what I'm actually thinking to people, and they're not going to judge me. Or if they do judge me, it doesn't matter because, you know, my higher power accepts me no matter what other people think. And I never had that before. I never knew that was possible. Like, it is so lonely to be in AA and convince yourself. Nobody else is telling you this, but convince yourself that you can't be yourself. You can't be honest. You can't say what you're thinking. You can't share with other people. And you can't have a real relationship with anybody, because that's what it takes. And you can't really get help in that way, or at least I couldn't. And that was so, so lonely. But it's been so many years now since that's been my life. You know, my life today is the opposite. I feel like, you know, through lots and lots of practice, I've gotten to be very open with people and be very genuinely who I am. And that feels amazing. You know, I've gotten to not only establish but maintain a healthy relationship with several people, you know, which I also thought was not possible. You know, I have a wonderful person in my life. I have great friends who are actually my friends because they know true things about me and I know true things about them. And, like, I have a good relationship with my sponsor. You know, I ended up completing college and then going back for more college and doing that sober. And, you know, going away for work and research trips and, like, staying sober through that. And, you know, I still don't have, I guess, an ideal outward circumstance. You know, I'm almost 30 and I still live at home. But I did get my driver's license, y'all. I got it 2 years ago. So that's changed. And the inside job is just so much better. And that's what really matters here, because, you know, a house and a car, they're not going to keep you sober. But if your insides are okay, then you get to stay here and wait for it to get even better, which is really where I feel like my life is going. You know, I can say that today, is that I can truly believe that it only gets better from here. The longer I stay sober, the better it gets. And that can be the truth for anybody here if you're willing to put the work in to stay. Yeah, so currently, actually, I'm one of the reasons I'm really glad I was asked to speak here is because I'm preparing to go away. I'm preparing to go abroad for about 3 months, and that's an amazing opportunity, but it's also terrifying. I'm not going to be alone there. I'm going to be living with a sober person, but, you know, not all the meetings are in English. There are meetings, thank God, but, you know, not all of them are in English, and, like, I won't really know anybody else there other than the sober person I'm living with, and, like, it's going to be really far for a really long time, at least in my experience. I don't have anything to compare it to that far away, that long. But I also know that I am going to be okay. I'm going to be taken care of. And, you know, I'll just do what we do here. I'll do what's suggested of me. I'm going to keep in touch with my sponsor. I'm going to keep in touch with friends. I'm going to go to those meetings that half of them aren't in English. And I'm just going to go anyway. And I'm going to be fine. If I do those things, I'm going to be fine. And I'm going to come home and I'm going to tell you all how great it was. And, you know, that certainty, that faith is not something that I ever had before AA. And it's one of the main gifts that I've been given, among many of the others. And then after that, after I get home, I'm going to go to Baltimore and live there. And then, you know, have to do it all over again. But it's all going to be fine. You know, I can say that truthfully. I can still be afraid to do it because it's new and I hate new things. But, you know, I can still be reasonably certain that it's going to be okay and I do not have to drink over it, which is amazing because I used to drink over the most trivial thing. But I'm facing some big life changes coming up, and I know that I don't have to drink. In fact, I know that drinking would absolutely destroy anything that I try to build from here on out. So I haven't quite made it to the full time, but I think that's the longest I've ever spoken. And I think I covered decently like what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like now. It's a little bit hard for me because I don't have a very long drinking story. I don't have a long, you know, drunk log with a lot of interesting stories, no felonies, no, you know, nothing really flashy or exciting. I was just kind of a run-of-the-mill teenage pain in the ass. And, you know, I did a little property damage here and there. I would steal a couple things here and there. You know, I'd black out places, throw up on things and people. And, you know, that was basically my story, is just low-level wreckage scattered around about 3.5 years of, like, pissing people off and making mistakes and blacking out and throwing up. And that's really it. But really, I guess what's more important to me is, like, the what's happened and what it's like now, because I've now been sober, like, 4 times as long as I drank, and about, you know, about half of that has actually been effort, but it's been enough that I just want more, you know, and I know it's all here for me if I keep doing the work and I keep being sponsored and I keep doing the steps and I try to help others. That's one part of my story that, you know, I do kind of judge myself a little bit for, is that I do not currently sponsor anybody. You know, I want to, I'm willing to, but it's a little bit hard to do if you don't really share in meetings and people don't really know who you are, what you have experience with, as has been pointed out to me many times by my sponsor. But I've also found that, you know, for me, the 12th step can also look different than just sponsoring people. It can be setting up the meeting. It can be giving somebody a ride home. It can be taking the extra time to have a real honest conversation with somebody who's struggling about something, and then having them be really grateful that you relate, even though they never expected that you would. You know, for me, that's what my 12th step looks like. And of course, coming out to speak when I'm asked to speak. And you know, thankfully, that's been enough so far. But you know, everything that I've gotten to do in AA, even the parts where I fall down or don't do quite as well as I wish, or, you know, doesn't look the way that I want it to, is all better than I could do by myself, for sure. You know, this is a life I would never have imagined in my wildest dreams, and it's all due to this program and the people in it who've taken the time to listen to me be crazy and drive me home when I can't remember what my address is at, like, 2 months sober. And, you know, all the people that have given of themselves. And, you know, it's my job. It really is my primary purpose to try and give away a little bit of what I've been given here by doing things like this. So thank you all for the opportunity to do that. And I'm really grateful to have been here speaking to you. And I hope somebody got something out of that. thank you so much.